Well, good afternoon. I hail from here, Indianapolis, so let me add my word of welcome to our fair city. What a productive time it has been. But I will also begin with a confession. As someone who spends a little bit more time in the world of policy analysis than political philosophy, I feel a bit like George Pataki at the GOP candidates debate. I feel like deferring more time to my fellow panelists and indeed even the moderator.
You're better.
So it's a privilege to be here, and even more so because of you, members of this society, who spend your days championing the cause of liberty and indeed educating us as citizens in a way that honors our founders. So it is a delight to be in your company. I would like to add my word of gratitude to Lenore Ely as well, who invited me on this panel. Lenore and I spend quite a bit of time over bourbon and IPAs debating any number of things. First, thinking about how the Philadelphia Society can prosper and the philanthropic enterprise prospects can be furthered. A little more contentious on college football, Badgers and Tigers, and whether Abraham Lincoln was a good president or not. Things get more contentious still. Here in Indianapolis, we like to say that Indiana made Lincoln, and then Lincoln made Illinois. When Lenore and I were sitting at the feet of Jim Curtis one time during one of our sessions, I posed the question to this great historian, was Abraham Lincoln an Indiana citizen? So Lincoln moved here, in his own words, about this time the state became a part of the nation. In fact, it was a few months before Indiana became an official state. And he left at age 21, just when he was eligible to vote. So it's an interesting academic question about his Indiana citizenship. But what's not debatable is how much he appreciated his education received in Indiana. Of course, we have the iconic image of Abe on a log reading a book. But I find it fascinating that he authored personally two autobiographical sketches, one in the 1860 campaign. And as he described his life on the frontier, he took the time in that brief sketch to list all five, or to identify all five of his teachers that he benefited from in his youth, which I think is a remarkable thing. By the end of that century, so 50, 70 years after this time, Indiana being pretty good at teaching citizenship altogether. As a matter of fact, there was in Lincoln's day, of course, it was reading, writing, and ciphering to the rule of three. But by 1915, as our schools were taking shape across the state, there was a report filed by the U.S. Commissioner of Education. And yes, in 1915, there was a Commissioner of Education. And in this report, though, the commissioner cited Indianapolis elementary schools as the case study in successful delivery of civic education. The city was hailed for its integrated approach to civics. Quoting the report, the civic aspect of education permeates the entire work of the elementary schools in this city, unquote, even diffusing, though, an elementary arithmetic. This from P.P. Claxton, the commissioner himself, who said in his introduction, from the inception of the tax-supported public school system in the United States, one of the most important functions has been to give the instruction and training necessary for the intelligent performance of the duties of citizenship. Indeed, the work of preparing for citizenship has been and still is one of the strongest arguments for making education a function of the state. Undoubtedly, we can talk about education in its rightful place in private society, but how remarkable, at least, the value given to the teaching of citizenship in the early part of the last century. 100 years later, that is hardly the case. In the early 1900s, education apparently was paramount to educating for life. The definition of civics used by, again, Indianapolis's public schools reads, "Civics is training in the habits of good citizenship rather than merely a study of government forms and machinery." In particular, there were four pillars that the Indianapolis Public Schools ran on. First, to help the child realize that he's a responsible and helpful member of several social groups. Second, to awaken and stimulate motives that will lead to the establishment of habits of order, cleanliness, cheerful cooperation, sympathetic service, and obedience to law. Third, to emphasize the intimate and reciprocal relation between the welfare of the individual and the welfare of the home and society. And fourth, to develop political intelligence and to prepare the young citizen for its exercise. So in other words, these schools were attempting to cultivate what Tocqueville referred to as the habits of the heart. Today, again, as you know, not so much, but there are some who call for such things to take place. Former U.S. Representative from Indiana, Lee Hamilton, you may know, is toiling now at IU at a Center for Congress. He says, "Democracy is hard work. Each new generation of Americans must learn that the freedoms we carry with them enjoy obligations, to be informed about issues, to listening to opposing views, to work in a civil manner, to resolve conflicts that inevitably arise in a nation as large and diverse as us." It is this thinking, or this sentiment, that led Sagamore Institute, our think tank, to form a partnership with Bill Bennett 5-6 years ago after the publication of his textbook series, America, Last Best Hope. Ed Meese is in the room. I'd like to ask him if this is true before I say it, so I'll look for a nod one way or another. But what I heard Bill Bennett say is that he was with President Reagan near the end of the president's life, and the president said to him that one of the burdens weighing on his heart was America's loss of identity. And Bill Bennett self-pledged then, as he told me the story, that he wanted to do something about that, which has inspired this America's Last Best Hope series. And after this exchange with President Reagan, Bennett spoke with David McCullough, who said, statistically, the president was exactly right. National assessments prove, as I'm sure you know all too well, that our student learning in U.S. history scores worse than any other subject. It's really quite pitiful. One survey that I read of students from 55 of our most elite colleges and universities found 40% who couldn't place the Civil War in the correct half century, and more than a third of those couldn't identify the Constitution as the document establishing our government's division of powers. I could go through a litany of K-12 stories, anecdotes that I'll either you'd find hilarious or deeply saddening, depending on your quotient of dark humor. But Bruce Cole calls this America's amnesia. The longer we spend in school, the less we know about America. It's a tragedy. But it's also a classic cause and effect. As American high schools have traded instruction about the American Revolution for global studies, instruction about our ideals and our institutions shouldn't be a surprise that they have waned. For those of you that, the students that do, most of our instruction is on these matters is relegated to the lower grades. For those students that do take advanced placement history, we will hear from, I think, Bill McClay, what went wrong there. I heard a terrific speech thanks to YouTube, Matt, at one of your conferences where Bill teaches us about the problem with curricula today and the poor teaching. So either we're not getting it or we're hearing the wrong things often. So this project with Bill Bennett that Sagamore was privileged to partner really brought forth a different learning style in addition to a much more expressive and muscular treatment of the American narrative, eschewing the memorization of facts and figures, the mentioning syndrome. Bennett's work places the who, what, where, and when in historical context. And the Bennett test that I loved when he presented this idea to us is the flashlight test. He likes to ask audiences, the last time that they caught their kid, hiding under the covers past bedtime reading an American history book, because that's just how gripping the American narrative is, we know. The blood and guts and the glory and the ideals and the religiosity and the meaning of life, these things are all in our story, of course. It will motivate so much of us to do what we do, but it's not what we read and it's not what we hear too often in educational materials. So we partnered with Secretary Bennett and created something called Team Hope, which was an educators network to go and work these products into the schools, because of course, as you know, it's very hard to get textbooks placed in a monopoly or duopoly that exists in K-12. We were good at it. We got a large percentage of schools in Indiana to teach these materials, so much so that Bennett got an invitation to go to Houghton Mifflin, whose CEO said, "Congratulations, appreciate your work. You took X or Y percent from our market share in Indiana. We can live with that. You take that market share away from us in Texas or California, we're going to be pretty grumpy." So they bought out the textbook series, and so they're making money putting it in classrooms, which is indeed the goal we had. Bill's made enough money. This is a time for us to get better materials in the classroom. I was privileged to serve for a couple years in the Bush administration, where we transferred the question of including the question of how to teach better in civics education in schools, also considered the question post 9/11, when we had such a renewed spirit of patriotism, how do we teach the citizen? What does it look like to engage a populace that is often so disinterested, or the beneficiaries of too little quality content? And so working with the likes of Les Lankowski, who I think is a friend of this group, and Lynn Cheney and others, there are a couple of initiatives I'll mention to you. I was quite proud to be a part of. Working under Bruce Cole's leadership at NEH, we launched We the People, which was an initiative that, among other things, in the spirit, Dane Starbuck of the Liberty Fund created a We the People bookshelf that delivered classics reproduced for K-12 schools, 9,000 of them nationwide, Picturing America, which was a deep dive into some of our greatest works of art, depicting the grand American narrative and making these images online to the population and grow our appreciation. We did a second initiative, perhaps you're familiar with, called Our Documents, identifying 100 milestone documents of our history kept by the National Archives, and making them available in a dynamic website. Of course, in addition to obvious documents such as the Constitution, Emancipation Proclamation, and Civil Rights Act, lesser known and vitally important documents such as the Lee Resolution, which is first to propose independence, Jefferson's secret message to Congress regarding the exploration of the West. It's a remarkable website that the next president hasn't taken down, we're pleased to say. But Indiana's National Treasures, of course, Liberty Fund, who you all know well, and its Library of Liberty Remnant Trust, its preservation of these same documents and heightening access to all of us are rich treasures indeed. So we love to be allied with those who further the cause beyond our classrooms to the classroom of our communities and our workshops and our kitchen tables, where this conversation needs to be vital. So I'll conclude with a pledge and a request. The pledge is that our think tank, located here in the heartland, wants to be helpful to furthering such pursuits. We are hosting in November the first of what will be an annual event called the Indiana Conference on Citizenship. We want to have a smart conversation around these themes. We want to further much of your good works in written and spoken form, so that is the request, to share with us your ideas, and to the degree you're interested in sharing your labor, we would like to engage you in this effort. But our founders understood, of course, that setting forth a system that we enjoy that so strongly emphasizes rights, constant efforts to remind us of our duties are necessary. And so therefore, we're building the conference to illuminate both the character of America and the cause of America. We seek to accomplish these goals through two objectives, to educate and to engage. The first is cognitive. What do Americans know about the country's history, core ideas and values? Of course, democracy, like unlike any other form of government, is not self-perpetuating. Its ideas and principles must be taught and transmitted, so we will do our best to do that in the conference and in related materials. Amy Cass calls for thoughtful patriots. That would be success if we could generate some of those on our first goal. That's goal number one. The second is operational, this goal of engaging citizens. How are citizens translating the knowledge that they're acquiring about what it means to be a citizen into lives of civic action? Do we live lives of service following Washington's admonition that liberty was, quote, the work of joint councils, joint efforts, common dangers, sufferings, and successes? Engage citizens, that's our goal number two. Wordsworth said, what we have loved, others will love, and we will teach them how. McCullough echoes Matt's good work, and we still hold these truths in saying to be a good citizen, we have to reassess what we mean by the word love. Love of country isn't just waving the flag. Love of country isn't knowing its story only, knowing its values, its liberties. Everything has been passed on to us by so much in the way of sacrifice and genius. We need to celebrate its glory. We need to celebrate its purpose. For those of us who do love our country, we need to do our best to teach others to love it the same. And with that, I thank you again for all you do to further that cause.